Hi, this is Sally.
And this is Emma.
Before we start today's episode, we just wanted to say a few things. We record all of our interviews in advance, sometimes months in advance, and this was certainly the case for this episode. The two interviews that follow took place well before the current COVID-19 pandemic of 2020 and its resulting impacts on our communities and our cities.
We've recorded our conversation with the exceptional Felicity Watson, who you'll hear from shortly, at the SB in September 2019, when pubs were open and close proximity in recording studios was safe. And we chatted to Sophie and Anna from Gill when they were in Australia way back in March 2019. In fact, this is their very first interview for This Is Public, recorded on location in a bustling Melbourne city centre, when people were everywhere, moving about their day-to-day lives.
We wanted to let you know this because right now our cities are very different places and there's something a little bit surreal about hearing the sounds of such an active, peopled city centre during Sophie and Anna's interview. But there's also something timely in what they talk about how a disrupted city helps us understand the importance of the public realm and how paying careful attention to how people interact with a disrupted city helps us design, plan and make better cities, better places for people and better public spaces in the future.
And lastly, we wanted to let you know, dear listener, that this is the last episode of this season of This Is Public and our final episode for now. So with that in mind, we wanted to take a moment to give special thanks to everyone who's been a guest on our show. There's been some incredible people who have been in the SV podcast studio bar. And also big thanks to our incredible creative team, Dan West and Chris Andrews. Also, the Open House Melbourne team, Victoria Bennett, Brianna Carroll, Tim Leslie, the Open House board, and all of our supporters and partners.
And of course, to our presenting partners, the SB and Metro Tunnel Creative Program, particularly the incredible Mary Parker, our deepest thanks for your support. And a very heartfelt thank you to you, lovely listener, and everyone who has subscribed and shared this podcast over the past year. We hope you enjoy this episode. Here it is.
This is Public.
This is a podcast about cities, people and place, produced by Open House Melbourne.
This is Emma Telfer.
And this is Sally McPhee. We live in Melbourne, Australia, and we love our city.
We've been friends for years, but come from kind of different careers.
But recently, we've started working together on public programs about the city.
We saw the opportunity for documenting, sharing, and making more public the content and ideas of our work.
And these same projects also bring together thinkers, doers, and advocates who are shaping our city.
To be public is to be shared. So this is us, sharing some of the stories, ideas and issues consuming our thoughts via a podcast. All made possible by the Metro Tunnel Creative Program, a program dedicated to enhancing city life alongside the construction of the Metro Tunnel.
Welcome to This Is Public.
Hello, Emma.
Hi, Sally.
Welcome to episode 5 of This Is Public. Resistance and Regeneration is the name of this chapter. Remember back when we were first thinking about this podcast and mapping out what each episode might be about? We initially called this Resistance to Regeneration, but the closer we came to making it, the more that didn't feel right.
Yeah, the more people we connected with through this podcast, people who were advocates or working across both resistance and regeneration in regards to the city, we realised it's not always simply regeneration people resist or oppose through community action or planning objections. It's more nuanced than that. There are many more shades of grey.
Yeah, the archetype when it comes to urban resistance is probably the NIMBY, the not-in-my-backyard stereotype, who are often portrayed as resisting for resistance sake, of wanting things to stay the same. But people push back for all sorts of reasons.
New doesn't always equal bad, and resistance can sometimes not be about what's changing, but how. In fact, urban regeneration comes with opportunities to hear concerns, talk about what we want as citizens of cities and towns, find commonality, or at least listen to other perspectives, and importantly, be part of shaping the future city.
In this series so far, we've traversed a number of urban landscapes. We started with water and our relation to it in an urban context. We talked about planning for the future needs of cities and how this takes patience, creativity and tenacity.
We've talked with emerging architects about collective agency as a key to changing the profession and in turn our urban environment, and considered the deep responsibility that comes with working on First Nations land.
We've talked about access, inclusion, and the rights to the city.
And throughout, we've prompted listeners, you, to pay attention to what's happening in your city, to take action and demand better outcomes. And in this episode, we're looking at how that manifests as resistance with something very dear to the roots of Open House Melbourne, heritage buildings and landscapes. We talked to Felicity Watson from the National Trust, an advocacy and membership-driven organisation who champion heritage places, landscapes and buildings and help the public do the same. Felicity unpacks what heritage is in all its guises and the public's role in advocating and saving some of our city's most enduring built treasures.
And then we'll explore how embedding generosity into regeneration projects can help us see our city anew via something very dear to the roots of This Is Public, the Metro Tunnel Creative Program. We'll chat to urban researchers from GAIL, Sophie Christ and Anna Musig.
But first, let's go to the SB, a place that's seen its fair share of both resistance and regeneration, where we meet Felicity Watson from the National Trust of Victoria.
So my name's Felicity Watson and I'm the Executive Manager of Advocacy at the National Trust of Australia, Victoria. So the National Trust is a membership organisation, so we're really supported by the community. As Executive Advocacy Manager, I lead a small team of advocates. There are four of us, and we advocate for the protection and celebration of cultural, natural and Indigenous heritage right across the state of Victoria. At its most fundamental level, heritage is what we want the future to inherit. It's the legacy that we want to leave for future generations. And there are many different ways of interpreting that. Part of it is about an architectural legacy and looking at the way that architectural styles reflect our history. But it's also about the social aspects and the cultural aspects of our heritage as well. I use those words to describe the type of heritage that we advocate for because I want to be very clear and be able to communicate the fact that we're not just looking at old buildings, we're looking at a broad range of heritage places, and it's problematic to delineate those into different boxes because they're actually very connected and there's a lot of overlap between those things. So Indigenous heritage is cultural and natural heritage. I don't think it's possible to actually separate those things out. It's really important to look at our environmental heritage places like landscapes as cultural places as well. They're places that have been managed by humans for tens of thousands of years. So it's not enough to look at a place of natural beauty and just see it as a purely natural environment. We have to look at the cultural layers of those places too. I'm a custodian of a role that has existed for a number of decades throughout the Trust history. It's a very interesting and almost unique role in the planning system and in heritage. It's really at the intersection of heritage practice, urban planning and community engagement. I like being where different things intersect and understanding lots of different things and how different ideas can contribute to the present and to what we do in our everyday lives. And so I actually find it quite difficult to describe what I do because I'm not a planner, I'm not a historian, I'm not an architect, but I do work where all of those things intersect.
So picking up on the idea of the intersection, I think it would be worth taking a moment just to unpack how local and state and federal government work in the heritage context, because it's a really complex space and I think there's a lot of public confusion around who's responsible for the protection and the conservation of some of our most significant sites. And we'll just focus in on buildings because This Is Public is very much about our built environment. Where does the National Trust sit? What are your responsibilities and how much control does the National Trust have?
The National Trust does not legally protect places. Our role is really to advocate for the legal protection of places. And much of our heritage legislation now, such as the Heritage Act, which was originally the Historic Buildings Act in the 1970s, was really based on work that had been done by the National Trust to identify and classify heritage places. But what we're doing now is to try and advocate for heritage to be assessed and protected in an ongoing way. The work to identify heritage places is never done. It's something that needs to be reassessed and re-looked at over time. And so the National Trust role has really evolved into an advocacy role, advocating at all levels of government for heritage places to be protected.
So can we just unpack maybe at a state level the heritage process or registration process around protecting buildings? And so what's happened for a building to sit on the state register and what's the relationship between that and then, say, local government heritage overlays and then perhaps a federal listing?
It's a four-tier system in Australia. So if you think about heritage protection, it kind of looks like a pyramid in terms of the volume of places protected. So the smallest number and most special places are protected at the world level, the international level. And the most recent inscription in Australia on the World Heritage List was Budge Bim in Western Victoria, a 6,500-year aquaculture system, really incredible legacy to the world. We then have the National Heritage List, which is governed by the Commonwealth Government. There are about 120 places on the National Heritage List, and they're supposed to be the places that really define our national identity. We then have state heritage registers. We've got the Victorian Heritage Register, which is administered by a state government department called Heritage Victoria, which administrates the provisions of the Heritage Act. And then local heritage protection is at local government level under the Planning and Environment Act. So local councils are really required to administrate local heritage protection at that local level. And so in terms of numbers of places that are protected, there are about 2,500 places on the State Heritage Register, but more than 180,000 places that are included in local heritage overlays under the Planning and Environment Act. So that's where that pyramid sort of diagram comes in. And I often see that there's this perception that it's a hierarchical system of protection, that places on the state heritage list are by definition more important than places that are protected at a local level. But at the National Trust, and personally, I don't believe that that is the case. What it means is that places are important to different communities. And so in managing those places, we need to understand what those communities are and what the values of those places are. So just because something may only be locally protected doesn't mean that it's any less important than a place that might be on the state register.
And even those things that come under a heritage overlay at a local government level, it doesn't necessarily mean they're automatically protected either, does it? Like a heritage overlay is a sort of stopgap, as I understand it, like something that people can still apply for a permit to demolish a heritage overlaid site. Is that right, Felicity?
Yeah, so a heritage overlay means that heritage and heritage values have to be considered as part of the planning process. In Victoria, we have an integrated decision-making process around planning, which means that when making planning decisions, responsible authorities like councils need to take into account a whole range of issues. So if a place has a heritage overlay, heritage might be a very important issue to consider in the future management of that place, but there might also be other issues that need to be considered, like the need to provide density, like the need to provide services. And so decisions are made which take all of those things into consideration. It's relatively rare for a planning permit to be issued for the full demolition of a place under a heritage overlay. Usually there will be some kind of compromise where part of the building is retained, but some of those other considerations are also considered in the final design as well. But it certainly means that it's not the only thing that's considered when a planning decision's made.
How on the front foot are you at the National Trust around identifying sites? How much is it about the community's rallying cry around a building that sort of piques the interest of the Trust compared to how much it is about your team, your advocacy team, identifying sites that are at risk or identifying parts of the city that perhaps are at risk?
So I would say that at the National Trust, but also at local and state government level, we're all on the back foot in terms of identifying heritage places that need to be protected. And the reason for that is that there haven't been sort of systematic and methodical studies done of what our heritage is and how it all fits together in context and sort of balancing what we want to protect versus what we're willing to compromise on. What we find is that often heritage protection is driven by threat. Heritage advocacy is very much driven by threat. We're often sort of putting out fires instead of having a proactive approach to identifying heritage. That consistent, methodical work hasn't been done over time. So, for example, at a local government level, lots of heritage overlays in local government areas are based on studies that were done in the 1980s and the 1990s. In many cases, they haven't been revisited since that time. And so the current heritage protections don't necessarily reflect contemporary significance and the contemporary values that people have around those places. And often it's only in the context of development threats that those things are examined. So a really good example of that was the demolition of the London Hotel in Port Melbourne. A really significant 19th century pub located near Station Pier that would have been a really important social place for people visiting Melbourne, but also people in the local area. It had been assessed as part of a heritage study done many years ago where the heritage consultant at that time didn't think it reached the threshold for local significance because it was a 19th century hotel, but it had an early 20th century intervention. So they saw that as the building not being intact. Whereas, you know, now I would look at that place and say, well, that's actually indicative of its significance. It's a place that was important to people over a long period of time and has changed in response to that. And so there was a development threat for that building and a sort of last-minute scramble by the city of Port Phillip to try and protect that place under a heritage overlay, but it wasn't successful. And so what really became evident was that the local heritage protections weren't in line with current community expectations, but also contemporary thinking about heritage and what it is and why it's significant to people. And then obviously the loss of the Greyhound Hotel in nearby St Kilda also compounded that loss as well, and it was a very similar situation. So that's been a catalyst for some councils to reconsider the way that they assess heritage and to look at gaps that they might have, but it's a very slow process to try and address those things while there are significant development threats.
I just got so sad when you mentioned the Greyhound. I think those places that are of real social significance are sometimes the hardest to deal with when they're let go. When you were talking about the Greyhound, I mean, we're in the Espy right now. A really great example of a place that's been fought for over and over again because of its social significance. And I think of the palace in the city, Old Metro Palace, whatever you want to call it, that place as well, and the big fight that went on around its preservation.
I think the Palace Theatre is a really good example of contemporary issues around heritage protection and the difficulties that we're facing in heritage advocacy. That was such a strong example of a place where there was a really engaged and passionate community around that place. They weren't necessarily community that identified themselves as a community before the threat was facing that place. But the battle to save the Palace Theatre really brought to the fore the fact that the methodologies that we have around assessing heritage significance are very dominated by ideas about built heritage significance and architectural significance and that sort of street-facing aspect of buildings. Whereas what was really important about that building was the theatre inside and the amazing decorative schemes that had been created over time, the amazing life that was in that building over many decades from vaudeville to, you know, rock and roll. It was a place where people could be entertained. And I think there's a real tension between places where they're privately owned but have a public function because people feel a sense of ownership over that those places. But when it comes to the crunch, they don't necessarily have agency in the future management of those places. And every time I walk down the top of Bourke Street, I feel sick because the Palace Theatre is still closed. It's boarded up. There's no start date for the development. And to think of how many concerts and gigs could have been happening in that theatre in the interim period while we wait for whatever's coming next for that site. But I think that that particular building will always be a monument to the failures of heritage protection.
It's 5 years now, would it be? 4 or 5 years that it's been boarded up. And it's interesting as well when you think about the cultural identity of a city and the fact that Melbourne is very proud of its music identity or music persona, and that we're a music city, and that point that you just made around the public and the private and that tension, and yet we're losing these really significant music venues which have been place of performance and music for decades.
There have been some wins as well. One interesting one is the Regent Theatre on Collins Street, which was built in 1929, I think, and was a successful theatre but sort of went into disrepair, and that came under a very significant development threat by the City of Melbourne, in fact, who bought it and wanted to develop that site. And there was a huge public campaign to save the Regent Theatre, and a union green band was placed on the site, which was really influential. And the theatre, as we know now, ended up being saved, and it's now a treasured asset of our community, and the state government's just invested even more money in restoring it. And Melbourne really has an identity as a theatre town. And that little precinct with the Athenaeum and the Capitol Theatre, which has also recently been refurbished, is so vibrant and something that's a really important part not only of our community but also our economy and our tourism offer. So it's wonderful to see those places that were hard won thriving now.
You can't imagine the city without them.
And yeah. What's happened with Festival Hall? Because there was that multi-res apartment development proposal, but they were looking to retain significant parts of Festival Hall. But do you know more about that one?
Yeah, so Festival Hall was added to the Victorian Heritage Register. There certainly was a proposal for redevelopment of that site, but I'm not sure what the status of that is. Certainly it is still continuing to be open for concerts. So it's really good to see that being activated in the short term. I'm not sure what the long-term plans are, but at least the Victorian Heritage Register will provide some level of protection. Although, like heritage overlays, the Heritage Act isn't able to secure the use of a site into the future. So you can protect the fabric of a place, but you can't prescribe what the use of that place is.
Yeah, it's an important point, and also an important point around just because it is on the Heritage Register doesn't mean that it can't be changed, but it's about a considered approach to that change and thinking about how the evolution of a site responds to the significance. So I think there's a lot of misconception out there too around what heritage registration actually means for a building.
Yes, I think there is a perception by some people that if you put something on the State Heritage Register, you're locking it down at a moment in time and nothing can ever happen there. But that's really not the case. It's not about preventing change, it's about managing change while considering the values of that place that make it significant either architecturally or culturally. So a good example of that is Federation Square, which was recently added to the Victorian Heritage Register and is already seeing a huge amount of change happening within it. So there was the demolition of the Western Shard to accommodate the Melbourne Metro Rail station entrance. And so that is a big project that will take a number of years and certainly have a major physical intervention on that site. But there are ways to be able to do that in a successful way that respects what makes Federation Square a significant place in terms of its architectural significance, but also its cultural use.
Perhaps we could just talk a little bit more about some of the most significant campaigns in Melbourne's history, where the community has rallied, perhaps where the National Trust has rallied to try and save a building or save a precinct. And perhaps we can sort of unpack if they were successful or not successful and some of the outcomes or byproducts from those campaigns. You've already mentioned some, but are there others that come to mind?
The place that really epitomises the tension between heritage and development for me is quite close to my office. The top end of Collins Street, the Paris end of Collins Street, which I think is just an incredible cultural landscape of resistance and regeneration. And it's close to the National Trust offices, and the National Trust has historically played an important role in advocating for the protection of heritage places along Collins Street. There are some people I know and some people that I've met who would see Collins Street as a landscape of destruction because there are many people who see what has been lost in terms of the 19th century fabric of that place. But I think it's actually a really exciting cultural landscape that showcases so many different layers of significance and history and design over our sort of 19th to late 20th century history. So if you're starting at the top at Treasury, that beautiful J.J. Clark building that's right at the top of Collins Street, and you sort of look across the road and you've got Alcaston House on the right-hand side, and then you've got number one Collins Street, which is a place that I absolutely love, which incorporates some of the 19th century buildings from Collins Street's history into this kind of postmodern interpretation of that landscape with DCM's fantastic number one Collins Street building. You walk a bit further down, and on the left, you've got the Popper apartment building, one of the first residential apartment buildings in Melbourne, which is a really beautiful building. The City of Melbourne's recent HODL Grid Heritage Review has identified that as being a really interesting time in the city's development in terms of bringing residents from outside of the CBD into the CBD.
And sorry, what era is that building? What age is that?
I think it's 1970s, give or take.
Yeah.
And then you walk a bit further down and you've got Collins Place, which I really love. It's quite monumental, but I love the way that it sort of breaks with the HODL grid and is angled at 45 degrees to the street. So it opens up this public plaza with the space frame above it, which is really of its time and brings in an international influence. So Harry Cobb from IMPAY and Partners designed that in partnership with Bates Smart McCutcheon. And then there are some other really interesting buildings like Gilbert Court, which was one of Melbourne's first curtain walled office buildings and was built in 1954-55 in the lead up to the Melbourne Olympic Games. And that was a period and an event that created an incredible amount of change in the city at that time. And that was also a real driver of the historic preservation movement as well, because there were these threats to the historic fabric of the city because we were trying to modernise and become a more international city. And so, you know, some of these buildings represent losses in terms of preservation battles, but I think that in the long term, they've left this really amazing legacy that tells the story of our history.
It's interesting how a community grieves around this change and loss. And Chris Johnson from Context in a past conversation talked about how a community grieves around loss. And we were chatting about how really a lot of that grief is wrapped up in the fact that the building hasn't been respected through the next iteration or the new development being of a high design standard, a high built standard. And it was wonderful to hear you talk about Collins Street, and I could picture all the buildings that you were talking about. It's been quite successful in using setbacks in the evolution of Collins Street. And so there's that idea of human scale has been retained relatively successfully over the years. The city has to evolve and change and regenerate. What are your thoughts around how we can all, as a community, public community, but also as professionals, agitate for better design outcomes?
It's difficult to prescribe good design. I think it's really important for architects and design professionals to advocate for good design. It is important for us to think about what needs to be kept and the threshold for renewals. It's clear that in a city where our population is going to be doubling in the coming decades, we need to have a good hard think about what it is that we value and how we want our historic building fabric to contribute to our future city. And that may not mean retaining everything, but you know, what are we replacing those buildings with? An interesting example that came up recently that we were involved in was the proposed demolition of number one Victoria Street in Albert Park, which is a 19th century building that again was remodeled in the early 20th century and is sort of a really eclectic but, you know, charming contribution to what is really an interesting historic landscape. The building has a heritage overlay, but it is in quite poor condition. And so the owners of that building have proposed full demolition and replacement with a totally new building. We argued at VCAT that they hadn't fully considered the option of restoring the building and remediating some of the damage and reusing the fabric in the building. And there's been a really strong community campaign as well to protect that building because people really value what it contributes to the streetscape. But ultimately, what really wasn't able to get it over the line was the design of the replacement building. VCAT found that the building should not be demolished, that there should be a very high threshold for contemplating demolition for places under the heritage overlay. The replacement building was not of a high enough calibre to justify the demolition of the existing building. There certainly should be a strong encouragement of reusing existing fabric, not only for cultural heritage protection, but also for sustainability as well.
I heard someone describe it once as the urban churn, this kind of constant churning through buildings and destruction and rebuilding, destruction and rebuilding. And your point about sustainability and heritage buildings' role in that is really, really pertinent, I think.
Yeah, it's also an issue that we don't talk about enough in the heritage profession and in the heritage sphere. We talk a lot about cultural value and architectural value and protecting those values. But of course, buildings also have other values as well. And one of those is environmental values. So every building that you see has embodied energy within it. It's made up of materials that were extracted from somewhere. And so to just demolish that without any care and to put it into landfill is just an absolute waste of resources. And there's an increasing recognition with the climate emergency that we need to look at all spheres of our activity to ensure that we're looking at sustainable options. And I've been really heartened to see how much the architecture industry has engaged with that discussion and become signatories to the climate emergency and advocating for a response to that through their work. That's really important, that one way that architects can respond to that is through the reuse of heritage fabric.
I was just going to ask you how you feel about the city now and as it's changing. Are you optimistic about the future of Melbourne and the amount of change we're seeing now and the amount of change that is predicted and the big population growth and what that will mean for our built fabric in Melbourne? How do you feel about it?
I do feel optimistic. I know that there are lots of people that I work with in the heritage advocacy space who are very pessimistic about the future and the impacts and the threats that we face because of the population pressures and the need for new infrastructure and all of those types of things. But I feel like there's been a shift where we're dealing with those issues in a better way. So even with the major infrastructure projects that are happening across the city, from the Melbourne Metro Tunnel, the Westgate Tunnel, the proposed North East Link that's currently under consideration, there have been improvements every time in how they can actually give back to the community. These projects do provide opportunities to give back to the community, and the Metro Tunnel Art Strategy is a really good example of that. The North East Link was exciting because there was an urban design strategy that was co-created with the Wurundjeri Corporation, traditional landowners, that embeds cultural heritage within that planning process. I am optimistic also because Melbourne has a really engaged community. People really care about what's happening in the places where they live and work. There are a lot of people who are very engaged in the planning process, whether that's at local government level or at state government level. And the most important thing that we can have at a time of change is a very open and robust conversation where people are talking about the future and pushing for different things. There's never going to be consensus. We're never going to agree on what the city should look like in the future and how it should develop. But how we can get a better outcome is by having discussions and providing opportunities for communities to be involved in that process. That's where we get the best outcomes. And that's what we will continue to advocate for as the National Trust, at state government or local government level, to meaningfully provide opportunities for the community to be involved.
Thank you to Felicity Watson from the National Trust of Victoria for generously giving her time and sharing her incredible expertise.
Now we turn to regeneration. If you've been anywhere in inner Melbourne lately, chances are you've noticed there's kind of a big infrastructure project happening. Construction is well and truly underway on the Metro Tunnel, the 9-kilometre twin rail project, which will transform the city's public transport network.
In our last episode, we discussed how construction in the city and the resulting changes to the urban environment can be challenging for people trying to navigate the city, especially if they have access requirements. In response to this, the Metro Tunnel takes a creative approach to mitigating the impacts of disruption, soothing people during times of significant change.
The Metro Tunnel Creative Program supports artists, designers, and other creatives to develop creative interventions and projects in response to the tunnel construction, through things like pop-up parks, visual arts on hoardings and acoustic sheds, and sometimes podcasts. Developed in consultation with communities impacted by the tunnel construction, the creative program offers incredible opportunities for artists to create work and brings an element of delight to disruption in daily life.
A critical part of the creative program is the project's ongoing monitoring and evaluation, headed up by renowned global urban research and design group, GIL, the brainchild of one of the most respected contemporary urbanists, Jan GIL. Sophie Christ and Anna Musig are two researchers from GIL who were in Melbourne leading a public life survey as part of the creative program's evaluation. We met them on location in 2019 to find out exactly what this involves and what it means for public life in Melbourne.
Hi, I am Sophie Christ. I work for GIL out of our San Francisco office. I am trained as an urban designer, originally from Denmark, where I've been with GIL for 9 years.
I'm Anna Musig. I'm a project manager at GIL, also out of our San Francisco office. I'm trained as an urban planner, but my background is as a public art curator and producer, and I worked in New York City on a number of light-based, site-specific art projects before coming to GIL. So a lot of my work with the company is around how to leverage new ways of seeing our cities in order to make better cities for people. GIL is an urban design organization based in Copenhagen with offices in New York City and San Francisco, where we're based, and it comes from the work of Jan GIL, who actually has a long legacy in the city of Melbourne. So we're very excited to be here working on this project and sort of working in the footsteps of that legacy. GIL, as an urban design consultancy, is focused on making cities for people. It's a very simple premise. It seems sort of obvious, but actually it's kept us quite busy for the last 50 years of Jan's personal practice and then the organization's practice over the last 15 years as a number of Jan's students and collaborators created a firm in order to take some of the principles that he developed in his academic work to really take that into practice and help shape cities around the world. So what we focus on as designers and as researchers is actually how our built environment supports a high quality of life. And we start that in almost every project by observing the public life of a place, which is a word that not everyone sort of understands. You know, to think about, oh, public life is like a politician in their public life. But when we talk about public life, we think about the things that actually make the city run. People going to and from work, people enjoying a summer day, sort of like we are today in this square. Walking to work, spending time with your family, seeing your friends, just enjoying your time alone in the city, outside of your car, outside of your office, and outside of your home. And public life is the thing that we create together in the city. And we believe that it's the most important driver of quality, of value, of meaning in our cities is actually this thing that we call public life. And so we measure it and we try to understand the relationship between public life and public space. So that's programming, design, landscape architecture, and all the things that help make us feel comfortable and invited or uncomfortable and uninvited in our city's public spaces.
Can you please describe where we are and why you're here?
So we're here in Irvine Square, which is one of the sites of the Metro Tunnel Creative Program. The Metro Tunnel Construction Program is something that maybe many people are familiar with. It's something that's been disrupting the city for some time, and it's going to result in more trains more often. The Metro Tunnel Creative Program is a sort of follow-on to the construction. It's actually a program that's meant to take advantage of the opportunity of construction to help people see their city in a new way as an amazing opportunity to have more canvases for art and creativity in the city as an opportunity to cause people to become curious about construction and about the Metro Tunnel itself. And last but certainly not least, as a program to help lessen the negative impact of construction. You know, construction is something that changes people's daily patterns. It can slow down some people's movement for a temporary period of time, and the creative program is here to bring a little bit of joy to that experience. So we are here as Gale because we have a long legacy of measuring public life and how people experience the city, and we've been asked to come and try to evaluate the impact of the creative program on people's experience of the city and of the construction project itself.
We are conducting public life surveys across the construction sites where public art has been installed or might be installed in the future. The public life surveys basically consist of observing what people do in the public realm, how they get around, what modes they are moving by, and what they do when they stop and stay and spend time in the public realm. And specifically for this project, we're also interested in understanding whether people actually engage with the art in the construction sites and how they might do that. So for instance, one of the sites, you can peek into the construction through these little windows. A lot of people do that. It's quite a wonderful experience. And you can tell that people are curious about what goes on behind the fences and behind the hoardings. We are not doing this just by ourselves. This is actually a study that requires quite a lot of people on ground at the same time. So we have this lovely group of amazing volunteers from different backgrounds in Melbourne. So there is students from RMIT and from the University of Melbourne. There are people that work for the city. There are residents that live in the impacted areas. And quite an amazing group of people is helping us conduct this survey over 2 full days in the city. On top of these more sort of observational studies where we observe what people do and how they engage with the art, we're also interviewing people in the street. And these two components of the evaluation program is only a fraction of the evaluation framework, actually, and which will be a running survey that consists of a number of different ways of understanding the impact of the program.
In an observational kind of part of your survey, if you're watching people around a hoarding and you're looking for engagement, might that be them taking a photo
people stopping
or
and
them
looking.
Stopping?
Yeah. So we're looking to see how people engage with the art and the construction sites in different ways. So it could be something very visible and clear that people stop and take a selfie or take pictures of the art, or they look at the construction sites through the windows that are provided in some of the hoardings. But it could also be the more subtle things that people don't even be aware of themselves, that they like turn their heads when they walk by the art. And so we're spending a lot of time on the site observing people to really understand also all these like small little subtle clues that might say something about the impact of the art beyond what people would maybe say if they were asked directly about whether they engage with the art.
What this observational work often shows us in the cities where we work is these things that people often don't even know themselves, how they respond to their built environment. And the reason we do this is because we want to find powerful stories about how urban design, the creative program, and other types of interventions in the city, how that affects people's life. It's been quite interesting to do this observational survey. A lot of people, when they're trying to understand the impact of the arts, the survey method or the data collection tool they go to is a survey, right? What do you think? Did you enjoy yourself? Yes, no, on a scale of 1 to 5. And those things are really great. There's many things that you can't possibly understand without directly, explicitly asking. But we, you know, the crux of a lot of Gale's work is that you have to observe how people experience the city, and you have to measure what you care about. So if you really care about you know, things like public life, things like people stopping and just taking a moment by themselves to be alone and observe the city. If you care about those things, you should find a way to measure them. And so that's actually the fun part about our job, is that we travel the world and we try to find the metrics, the pieces of data that don't yet exist out there in the world, and we create the data in order to tell better stories, to make better cities for people. We need that data because there's already so much data out there that helps shape cities. Economic data, traffic data, lots of traffic data, public safety data. All these things are crucially important, but if we're not supplementing it about data, about how people experience cities, then we're really missing some of the most important stuff that we care about.
I had a question about why an arts or culture program would be linked to a major infrastructure program of works. Do you have any other examples from around the world that you'd like to refer to that have potentially demonstrated that they're an effective way of easing disruption?
Yeah, so the city of Copenhagen is going through a similar process with expanding our public transportation and building a metro, a circle line that connects to an existing metro line. And the city has had an art program, or the Metro Construction Firm has had an art program on the boarding there as well. And it has been a quite wonderful experience in the city to see these hoardings change with different kinds of arts throughout the years. And it has been quite successful, especially out in the neighborhoods where it's been disruptive to people's everyday life. Now almost coming to an end is at the last stages of the construction. One of the things that is coming out is actually people are starting to be concerned about losing their art walls, which is quite amazing. It doesn't necessarily mean that people want the construction to stay, but I do think it says a lot about, you know, how art can be a mediator and how important it is to people to have art in their everyday life and be able to engage with it and participate in actually putting the art out there as well.
I'll say something about why would an enormous multi-year construction program want to fund a public art program? And, you know, from an experiential perspective, from a city's perspective, cities are always changing. Every single construction project should have a creative expression on its outside. It's an amazing opportunity to put up a temporary wall that can be host to whatever that building wants to express, whatever that building owner wants to express, whatever that neighborhood wants to express. So, you know, we hem and haw about the cladding of a building and the design of a building in community meetings and in architectural design reviews. Why not take advantage of the special opportunity that there's a hoarding to do something interesting? So it's very exciting to be working here in Melbourne to see how much art there is in the city in general. There's so much public art here. Even the building architecture itself is so expressive. The historic buildings and the new buildings, as well as murals in the different precincts, different neighborhoods. So it's fitting that there is a public art program on the exterior of the construction, the Metro Tunnel program. So many other evaluations of creative programs like this have found really positive impacts in different dimensions, in sentiments towards the construction, in the revenue of businesses that are impacted by the construction, and to the artists themselves who see great boosts in their reputation, connections, and new collaborations by showing their work in the public realm.
Can you talk a bit about that evaluation process? What gets evaluated and what you do with the findings?
You know, we're hoping that the impact of the evaluation will both be able to tell some wonderful stories about what's happened here in Melbourne because of the creative program, and will actually help shape the program moving forward. So the construction is set to run for a number of years. The creative program is just in its infancy, actually, and starting the evaluation early is an opportunity for the curators and stewards of that program to make adjustments moving forward to really meet the needs of people. It's an opportunity to have a feedback loop in the process of design that is evidence-based and sort of focused on data and people's experience. The observational data that we've been collecting on site is actually collected in the same manner as Gail has been collecting public life data over the last 50 years. So when Jan was here working with Rob Adams in the 90s and authored one of the first Places for People reports that helped really catalyze a lot of the development downtown, the transformation of the laneways, the transformation of Melbourne City Center into a place where people really want to be, we have actually incredible data from the 90s about how people use space and how the relationship of life and form has evolved over time. So, for example, we know over time, the more sidewalk cafes are on the street, the more people are using them. The more public spaces there are, the more people are in those public spaces. And incredible data, like 20 years ago, people weren't spending as much time as they were in the evenings. And now we see lots and lots of nightlife, sort of civic nightlife in the downtown city center. So we're going to take the data that we're collecting just here, put that into the same database as all this data has been living since 1994, and make some comparisons between today and in the past, as well as compare the data from this evaluation to other sites around the world. So I mentioned that Gail has been working in over 250 cities around the world. We can actually compare data from Melbourne to many cities around the world, from Paris to San Francisco to New York City, and see how the public life profile of Melbourne really compares. A lot of people listening to this podcast might already know this. Melbourne is actually one of the leading cities in public life data collection, and they use that to create planning decisions that help advocate for people in the public right-of-way. So if a footpath is quite congested, we have data to actually say, hey, this should be expanded to make it a more comfortable place for people.
Yeah, and the city of Melbourne has really taken this on as their own project and a way to sort of help guide how they shape their city. So this Places for People is something that the city has continuously been working on, and they put out a report every 10 years, I believe. So there was one, 2014 was the last one, and basically helped shape this Melbourne that you know today, that's this incredibly vibrant city, almost too successful with congested sidewalks. It's like a luxury problem that would be the envy of many cities around the world. The data collection of public life is not new to Melbourne, but so the fact that the creator program here is extensively taking that on as part of their evaluation makes a lot of sense.
What's the most important or interesting or surprising part of evaluation and research, either on this project or other things? Do you find that it's the observation? Is it the interviews? Is it the difference, like you've said, between what people say and what people do?
You know what I'll say? Every single time, I've done this type of a survey in like a dozen cities. Every single time, the thing that surprises me the most is how good everyday people are at observing their city. Yeah. It's just amazing. So we're working with a couple of dozen incredible volunteers from the city of Melbourne, many of them students. And, you know, we're professionals, we're here to learn, we're here to bring our expertise to the fore. And these students, like these young people, just see incredible opportunities in their cities just by spending a focused time observing public life. So over 4 hours, I had all these volunteers coming to me at the end of their shift saying, I really think that everyone's clustering to the edge of Urban Square right here. You know, the middle part is quite sunny. The edge just has a little bit of shade. What if you just took the hoarding and, you know, turned it over like a small covering? And what if you asked an artist to do that? Wouldn't that be nice to have just a little artist-designed shade structure? So you're meeting someone's immediate need, but you're doing it in an artful way.
But that's one of the amazing things about working with so many volunteers that have different backgrounds, because they bring different perspectives to the evaluation. And we try and capture that as much as possible. One thing is, like, that we are actually out there ourselves all the time during the full survey with them and engage with them and have conversations with them. We also ask the ones that are very eager, and like anyone who has any other additional thoughts to share, to write them up and share them with us. I've been doing this for almost 10 years now throughout the whole world, and everywhere surprises me how people are so willing to put in their time and effort and also have all these great ideas and can actually bring things to the project that we didn't think about at all. And that's quite wonderful.
How does the success of the creative program relate to the success of the construction program? Does it?
Oh my gosh.
Or like, how do they feed into each other?
Beyond the art itself and the impact that that has on people's everyday life, like experiencing art out in the public realm. I do also think that the creative program is providing a different platform for community and resident engagement in the impacted areas. There's a different, it's a different focus of the engagement than the construction in itself, which allows to have a different kind of conversation and hopefully also a conversation that might be more positive because you have a different focus, not as a diverger, but as actually something that can bring people together. And I think art can play that role in construction projects and in many other projects.
Absolutely. I think there's a couple of dimensions that would mean success for us. If we look back, you know, in 5 years, what was the impact of the creative program in the city of Melbourne? I think one of them is sort of the bottom line is that people feel like the Metro Tunnel construction is their project. Melbourne is a creative city. It's known worldwide as being an incredibly wonderful, livable, creative city. Wrapping the construction project, which is about making the city even more livable and more connected in something that is just as Melbourne as the construction itself, as the transportation that it will deliver, helps people understand that that construction belongs to them. It's their taxpayer dollars. It's an investment in their life and their children's lives and their families' lives. So, you know, success means helping people see that this construction is for them in the future. I think underneath that, there's something quite exciting about especially the pop-up programs that will be coming with the Metro Tunnel Creative Program. It's beyond just the hoardings. There are some projects in certain precincts where the construction affords areas in the public realm that can be experimented on, and actually the program can help people learn what might be desired there. Is it a pop-up cafe or a set of chairs or maybe some shade, something very simple? And you know, something that we're always after in our work at Gale is helping people see that cities are changing things that can be changed by citizens themselves. And it's programs like this that allow pilot projects and experiments to sort of seed that culture of possibility in people so that when children who experience the creative program and grow up and they start going to community meetings in their neighborhoods, they can know that they can actually say yes to something. They don't only have to say no. You know, oftentimes community meetings and the public consultation process is filled with people saying, no, I don't want that. No, no. Oh, no, no, I don't want that. But this is an opportunity to help people see that there's ways that they can say yes in a sort of low risk, light touch way through pilots like this. So I think success means, you know, many different things. Certainly the successful completion of the Metro Tunnel program itself, but also this sense of possibility for the city that people can shape it themselves.
Thank you so much, both. Like, this, yeah, one incredible creative experience for all of you, but for those volunteers involved. A lot of people in Melbourne really take pride in their city and they want to be involved in the future of it, and that's certainly something Open House really try and foster. So thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you for inviting
us. We really appreciate it. And if anyone wants to know more about Gale and the work that we do.
If you want to learn more about Gale, you can visit our website. It's www.galepeople.com. You can follow us on Instagram or Facebook. We often share updates about our projects and work in the field.
Yeah, and if you're curious about learning more about our public life, public space surveys, we have a public life protocol that you can find online. It's open source.
A very big thank you to Sophie and Anna for their time and to the Metro Tunnel Creative Program for supporting this whole podcast. Resistance and regeneration will always be part of any growing city's story. A city is constantly changing, developing, regenerating, yet every generation resists this change to a certain extent.
Landscape amnesia or creeping normalcy sets in, where people believe the city has always been in the form they know and love. But as we learnt from Rob Adams in episode 2, Inner Melbourne hasn't always been a bluestone or treed city, yet these features are part of the city identity we hold dear in our minds as our city scales up at a rapid rate.
So we encourage you to be active participants in your city's story, to pay attention to regeneration, listen carefully to the reasons behind resistance, and embrace opportunities to be part of your city's evolution.
You've been listening to This Is Public, podcast series produced by Open House Melbourne,
an independent organisation that fosters public appreciation for architecture and public engagement in conversations about the future of our cities.
Learn more, including where and how to listen, at openhousemelbourne.org/thisispublic.
A deep thank you to presenting partner Metro Tunnel Creative Program and supporting partner the SB, who have brought This Is Public to life, and to Open House Melbourne's generous donors, partners and supporters.
This Is Public is hosted and produced by us, Emma Telfer and Sally McPhee, with support from Brianna Carroll and Victoria Bennett. Our music and sound design is by Dan West, and our audio editor is Chris Andrews.
We record at the SB Podcast Bar, Tweak and Twang Studio, Number Station Studios and on location.
This Is Public is created on the ancestral lands of the Kulin Nation, and we pay our respects to Elders past, present and emerging.
Thanks for listening.